from Madison West High School. Would they please stand?
Looking good.
Good of you to come, not from too far away. You may be seated. The students are here with us as a result of a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. The invitation is accepted. The students get some materials about the case, and they may engage in some activities relating to the case. Students then come, listen to the oral argument, and at noon after the second case, the students will meet with a justice of the court assigned for that day to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the cases that we are hearing today. And everyone is invited to join the students and the justice. We have a synopsis, a summary of this case available for anyone who wishes to get that summary. If you do, would you raise your hand, please? Okay, the marshal will do that. While that's being done, let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. She's the justice with whom you will meet at noon today. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will now call on our first case for today, which is 09-AP-438, David Broussard versus Stephen A. Reisman. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Reisman, and press enter, is Attorney J. Drew Ryberg. Mr. Ryberg.
May it please the court, this matter is of considerable interest to the litigants, but I think statewide as well, to know what happens when partners disagree and what you do to try to resolve that. Is it necessary in all circumstances that you have to dispose of all of the assets or close the business, get everything reduced to cash and divide it up? I don't believe that's a holding of the courts previously to this case, and I think as applied to this particular matter, what happened was that an accounting never was had, and the purpose of the lawsuit in 2007 properly was one for accounting. And that when the accounting has been made, it will be found that Mr. Bouchard has been more than paid the value that he had in the partnership interest. If I may go back with our mind's eye to the founding of this in 95, the two gentlemen got together and began this dial-up internet service provider business. In addition to that, they had a help desk and they had some other kinds of things that would be technological in nature. They called it a geek squad or something to respond to issues that may arise. But they never had any paperwork except for maybe a filing of the limited liability partnership agreement in 1998. Matters proceeded bumpily in those first few years. And then in the summer of 99, it was that Mr. Bouchard elected to terminate the relationship. And he wrote a letter, which is in the record. It is dated August 3 of 1999, saying that he wanted to get out of the business. He wanted to conclude it. And he thought that this would be a propitious time to be selling that business. It would have a value of $3 million. And that's what was written by his lawyer on August 3 of 1999. In addition, in the second paragraph of the letter, the lawyer for Mr. Bouchard stated that if we can't do it, maybe you want to buy me out along the lines that are indicated here, or namely something on the order of one half of that, because they're 50-50 partners from the inception in 95 up until the present time. What happened was that at about that time, there was an offer that came from a company called Voyager.net. And the value of that offer in the latter part of 99 was $3.5 million. When the various expenses necessary to close were factored in, the net of that was about $3.2 million. So divided in half would be roughly $1.6 million to each of those gentlemen at the latter part of 1999. There was difficulty with a number of the conditions of the potential sale to Voyager.net. There was a lot of questions about ongoing liability, questions about if people discontinued in the next 2 months or 6 months, would that come off the purchase price? COBRA obligations for employees of the company not picked up by the new company, Voyager.net. So the matter never resolved. And in fact, the circumstances were that finally the lawyer on behalf of Press Center was dealing with Mr. Bouchard and his lawyer and came back with another markup of the draft to send back to Voyager.net. And there was no interest ever expressed to responding further on that by Mr. Bouchard. That began an odyssey that continues to this day. And in August of 11, it will mark 12 years that Mr. Reisman has conducted the business on his own. Mr. Bouchard left in August of 99, and by his testimony, it's in the appendix, he spent less than 6 days in the business. It's also clear in the case that he was given partnership payments over this period of time of $2.4 million, and that the investment initially by each of the gentlemen was $15,000.
Counsel, it seems accurate to say that both partners received $2.4 million.
Yes, sir.
And I wonder if the record indicates why it is, and I know you're getting to this, the salary or the guaranteed draw as it's referred to. I wonder if it's in the record as to why your client did not either advise or seek the consent of Mr. Bouchard in regard to a salary. I mean, obviously the point you're making is a valid one, that there were significant partnership payouts here and someone had to be doing the work. But I wonder if the record discloses why that was never sought.
Your Honor, in terms of the payments themselves, that analysis by Mr. Kenyon would establish that the one-half value plus 5% was paid by about May of 04. The commencement of the draw to Mr. Reisman happened in January of 04. It was indicated in payments or the financials monthly what the payments globally were, but not specifically as to Mr. Reisman at that time.
Was that separated out as to identified in regard to the payments being made to Mr. Reisman, or there are some allegations in the briefs that that was lumped in with other general wages and payments so that it would have been impossible for the reader to discern that those were payments going to Mr. Reisman and some to Mrs. Reisman, although I don't think that's the subject of
I think the issue with regard to Mrs. Reisman is not in point, Your Honor. With regard to him, I think you're right.
I was just thinking of it as I was recalling the record. But yes.
You're right with respect that it was lumped into one category of salaries at that point. Mr. Reisman's testimony has been he consulted with his lawyer in Minneapolis who said he was entitled to do this, and he simply had to report that. And I think that's in the appendix as to why he did that, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
And as we get... I'm sorry. As we get into it more, the Voyager.net failed in 99, and then there were nine more offers that were attempted to be entertained over the course of the partnership, and none was able to be executed. And these involved considerable time on the part of Mr. Reisman to respond to each of these. So, Mr. Reisman.
Let me just go back, if I might, to Justice Gableman's point. Partnership distributes income, and each of the partners reports it. Right?
Yes.
Annually.
On a right? K-1, yes, Your Honor.
Did both partners have access to the partnership return and to the, a K, Schedule K, that each of the partners would get?
I think it is a K-1, Your Honor. I think that would reflect the payments by the partnership to each of the gentlemen.
Now, but if it's a 50% and one is drawing a salary, if you just looked at the K-1, you'd see that one of the partners is getting more money than the other.
I don't know that that's so, Your Honor, because that was salary as opposed to the K-1 distribution business. But the returns, I think, would reflect that. The returns
certainly
of the partners.
Something's going to reflect that.
Yes.
if there's not, if it doesn't show on the K-1, it's been a long time since I looked at that, K-1, it would show on a W-2 that the partnership would give.
Yes, and the returns generally were available to all the partners, or access to the returns was available. So the unenviable position was that Mr. Reisman had to carry the business to operate it and also attempt to sell it. And he performed that in relatively excellent fashion, and the partnership did very well for a number of years in the future, indeed to the extent that each was able to be paid $2.4 million. In terms of what's the applicable standard in the case, it seems that the accounting has to proceed to determine who gets value. And I'm here to tell you that the issue before you is who owes what to whom, and that really the basis of the real matter in controversy has not been resolved. There are two different ways to divide up the partnership, and the briefs refer to that. One is by the wind-up. One would be by the way of the continuation. And in terms of the methodology economically, the wind-up is that you try to resolve and sell all of the assets off, and then when you're done with that, you can divide what you have after paying the liabilities equally between the two of them. So the value necessarily at the beginning of the dissolution does not matter in the wind-up analysis, but for the analysis that's contained in Section 178.38 that says at the time that you have a dissolution, you have to have an accounting as of that time. So it's determinative as to that point. So the reference in the briefs to Mr. Kenyon not being relevant to talk about value at dissolution is not so, because that statute, 178.38, clearly says you value for some purposes what the interests are respectively at the time of dissolution. As distinct from that, the continuation would be that you continue with the business and you attain a value that is determined at dissolution. You determine what the interest of the partner is, and then there's an election the departing partner gets after that to take either interest on those dollars or profits attributable to the rights of the property that remain in the business. And that calculation can be done in election made later with regard to be it interest or with regard to the profits attributable business.
Counselor, in regard to the accounting, has there been a determination made about whether the amounts your client paid to himself as a salary were reasonable for the work performed, or is that something that you think is yet to come?
I think that is reflected in the analysis by Mr. Kenyon. That's appended to our appendix, Your Honor, and it talks about from 04 to 08 when he was paid a range on value for the work he did is like $740,000 to $921,000. But the work he did was beyond being a CEO. He did work as an analyst. He did work as an engineer, that kind of thing. So those kinds of jobs would be needed to be filled if Mr. Reisman had not done that. And that's a matter that probably should be factored in as well, Your Honor.
Well, but what I was trying to figure out is this, is has there been a determination made at the circuit court level of whether or not, if we were to conclude that he had a right to a salary, that what he paid himself was reasonable for what he did? You have to be in front of the mic or we can't record you.
Thank you. Uh-huh. There's been no court determination of that, Your Honor. It came to the court in Pierce County with regard to summary judgment. I sought summary judgment. There's a cross summary judgment, that kind of thing. And the court determined that as a matter of law, summary judgment ought lie with regard to Mr. Bouchard's.
So essentially what the court said is he should have nothing. That was the summary judgment of the court because there wasn't a right to a salary, correct?
Right, under 178.15.6.
Right.
And we think, Your Honor, that is too narrow an interpretation of the case, because if you measure it either by means of the wind-up, has he been paid value with regard to that? Well, we know at the outset what the value was thought to be, about $3 million, and we know that he got paid $2.4 million, and we know that at 5% interest, he was more than paid that sum by May of 2004. So, in effect, he's been paid about $500,000 more than that to which he was entitled by means of the methodology in regard to the area of wind-up. If you looked at it from the continuation standpoint, we know what those dollars are because we have the statement of his attorney, $3 million. We know because of the Voyager.net offer in November of 2009, that was $3.5 million. And we can walk through that and determine what that value would be. And that's that value of dissolution, which is, again, about $1.6 million, according to the analysis that we have done. So were he to take that election with interest, we know that that interest would have been paid, the 5% in full, by May of 2004. And if he does profits attributable, it's his burden to carry that according to the Madison case and to answer that question. But I think the fundamental...
Counsel, what if the business went down in value like so many other businesses have in the last several years? Would you make the same argument?
I would, Your Honor. I think by either measure, wind-up or continuation, there's been payment in full, because if we look at what the value was at the dissolution, we've covered that, we paid the interest on that, and we have reasonably taken care of the interest of Mr. Bouchard, because it was said that this was the value. That value's been met. So the question here is, if you go back and look and do the accounting, is somebody overpaid or not, and go from there?
I just don't get how you get around 178.15 sub 6. You're going to have to walk me through that a little more.
Sure. I'm uncertain, Your Honor, as to the context in which the case lies. I know the court says it's a wind-up, but this
Did
is...
Did you stipulate or not?
On summary judgment, I said that. But, okay. You know, I look at those cases, Your Honor, the four seminal cases, the Schaefer case, the Lange case, the Gull case, the Madison case. It's hard to know what happened in those cases because, for example, in Schaefer, the fellow thought that he was seeking a wind-up, but it was a continuation. In the Lange case, the court concluded there it was a wind-up, but then divided it up on continuation basis. In the Gull case, the continuation occurred to wind up the partnership. And in the Madison case, every single argument talked about wind-up, but the decision sounded entirely on the issue of continuance. So I do agree in the summary judgment. I did say that, Your Honor. But I don't think that just does justice to the case of whether or not the partner has been paid. And I submit he's been paid because if you look either at the wind-up value, and we know what the value was because we know what the offer was at that time in 99, it's like $3.5 million. Was he paid that value? He wasn't more, Your Honor. So I think that I don't even get to 178.15.6 on that issue. By the time that he is paying himself a salary, the other fellow has been disposed of and no longer has a right to be involved in the business. But by the same token, Your Honor, if you're looking at the accounting, how would you do that? If Stephen Reisman is doing a number of jobs, there ought to be credit given to the balance sheet for those jobs that he fills and the salary that he took. So if it's $160,000 and 90 or more of that represents jobs that he fulfilled in different areas from CEO, that should be attributed, and that's not been done either. So respectfully, Your Honor, I think that in a wind-up basis, he got paid more than value because we go back to that basis. Mr. Jacobberger said it's about $3 million. The Voyager.net was $3.5 million. So take the expenses off, get down to 3.2. He got the 1.6, one half of the 3.2, and he got interest on that. He got paid in full on that. So he's not entitled to more than that, Your Honor. And you really don't even reach the question of the 178.15.6 issue. But I confess confusion about what happened in all of these cases and what status we're in. You can't be required to go on forever.
Before we get to 178.15.6, I think we've got to stop at 178.15.1, where it says each partner shall be repaid that partner's contributions, whether by way of capital or advances to the partnership property, and share equally in the profits. And so I think that's where I'm seeing a little bit of a conflict between your several times now referring to the $3.2 million valuation in 1999 and reference to the 5% imputed interest or implied interest, saying that he'd been paid in full, when it seems to me that is in conflict with the principle that the partners are to share equally in the profits.
Well, I think that he has been allowed to share equally in the profits. He was allowed to get value of the business as well in this period of time. So he's not been slighted, Your Honor. I think that he's met this 178.15.1.
Right. So Okay, I agree so far, but I guess then I'm unclear as to, I'd like you to explain more or talk more about how your methodology, why are we talking about the 1999 valuation then?
I think because the accounting refers to that, the point 38 part of the 178 code talks about that. It's necessary, too, in the context of what Mr. Bouchard had wanted. He wanted to sell the thing or be paid his half value. And the question is, did he get value either by means of a sale or by his being bought out? Effectively, in the conduct of the business after that, he got one half the value, plus he got interest and more than that, Your Honor. So I think he was more
okay.
than that.
And then so what is the conclusion that you draw from that?
The conclusion I draw, Your Honor, is that value was met. I don't care what methodology was employed, continuation or wind-up. He's been more than compensated. And if it were sent back to the circuit court to get the accounting, we'd know if I'm mistaken in that notion and find exactly who owes what to whom. And that's never been done by the court. And respectfully, this is an equity matter that needs that kind of resolution.
Well, Counselor, to me, what you're saying is upon notice of dissolution, the partnership terminated. But I don't think that's the law. I think the partnership goes on until all the assets are sold and the liabilities are paid. So to say that he's been adequately compensated, he still had a 50% partnership interest. He had a right, whether it was wind up or continuation, and to go back and say, well, I operated the partnership and you got more than you would have gotten if we had been able to sell it to the Voyager.net, in my mind, presumes the partnership terminates on notice of dissolution, and the law is clear it does not.
I respect that, Your Honor, and I think, 178.25.2 says that as well.
Right.
And I'm not quarreling with that, Your Honor, but what I'm saying is that if you look at the purpose, which is to do equity, and you look at the accounting, did he get his value? Well, he did get value, and he got value because he got these payments over time, Your Honor.
But he had a right to them because the partnership was ongoing. So you're saying, well, we paid you half of the Voyager.net offer plus interest. Well, so, I mean, he had a right to that because the partnership was ongoing. For me, I'm more interested in whether your client had, either by equity or by some other reasons, the right to the salary that he took. Because as long as the partnership is ongoing until the partnership terminates, given that there was not an election made in writing to say, I'm going to take half of this value, I'm now down, I'm out of this partnership in regard to any increase in value or decrease in value, or I'm taking this half with interest, I think he's still in the partnership. I think everything he got, he had an absolute right to get.
Well, equity compels that Mr. Reisman be given a chance to look at the accounting and see whether it was appropriate or not. My response, Your Honor, would be that there can be acquiescence in a continuation. It doesn't have to be in writing in the case.
I don't doubt any of that.
Isn't there a letter? There's a letter in this case in October of 2006 that wants to have Mr. Bouchard back in, and he is saying that I'm into the management and that kind of thing. In the meantime, in getting all of these benefits over the 8 to 9 years, he's had the opportunity for this to have been continued. So he's got the best of all worlds in this case.
I don't doubt that, and that's why I focus more on whether your client should be compensated for giving him the best of all worlds. But I have a hard time buying your argument that he got paid his share of the partnership because he had a right to it until the partnership was terminated, and then it wasn't terminated.
Or counsel, stated differently, under sub 1, if the salary wasn't taken, there'd be increased profits to divide up.
Right.
That's
so
true.
So how do you get there under the language of the statute?
But if I had two or three other people that Mr. Reisman was filling for that would have been hired and included, probably the salary that he had would have been gobbled up and would be not relevant, in other words, to take that out.
So what you're saying is ignore the language of the statute and in equity say he should be paid.
I don't think I'm ignoring it, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that there's a right to figure value in this case, and I guess I look at the Gull case at 185 at page 622 and Lang at 121 with second 604 that talks about the unless otherwise agreed, a partnership may be wound up only through an accounting. So if the partners don't get along, and it says further, where voluntary settlement cannot be achieved because of partnership discord as here, and action lies in equity for an accounting. So that's what we're doing is accounting, Your Honor. And in the accounting analysis, it is that there's been more than payment to Mr. Bouchard on either a wind-up basis or a continuation basis. Because, I'm sorry, was there, because the accounting would indicate what value is at the time of the dissolution. Was it met or not? Well, it clearly was met in this case. And Mr. Reisman was entitled to be paid for the work that he did and effectively carried this business while also trying to sell it to suit the interest of Mr. Bouchard.
Under equitable principles or under the language of the statute?
Well, I think under equity clearly, Your Honor, but I think the language of the statute is met when I look at this case that says that you can fix a value as to what that partnership interest is because he wanted to sell in 99. We know what that interest is by the Voyager.net offer. We know what that is, and we know he got paid that. So we've met the terms of 178.15.6 and the other provisions of the statute because we know value. He got it. It was paid to him over time.
That's not when dissolution occurred.
Pardon me?
That's not when dissolution occurred. So back to what Justice Rogenczyk was saying.
You
have to speak up. You can't.
Dissolution occurred at that time in 99. Termination effectively could occur at that time if he got value, and that's what this Gull case and the Lane case say. You can determine market value and put that in, and that's what courts do all the time. And that's not unreasonable to do, Your Honor, respectfully.
Here's my problem. Partnership can be a contract, right?
Yes.
Okay. It should be a contract. If you don't make a written contract or an oral contract that the court can put into effect, the legislature has made a contract for the parties through the statute. And once you have a contract, the general rule is you hold people to the contract, even if it's not fair, even if it's not equitable. Unless it's unconscionable, then the court will strike down the contract. Here, the statute says no compensation for services rendered by a partner. The trial court held that, as a matter of fact, I think, that this was a wind-up, right?
Yes.
And the Court of Appeals said they're not going to upset that finding of fact, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we are stuck with a wind-up. And under the statute, no remuneration. The revised Uniform Partnership Act, which updates this language, would allow, as I understand it, a remaining partner to take a reasonable salary for services rendered. But Wisconsin legislature has not adopted that. So we're still with the old statute. And if Mr. Reisman and I would find it easier if you referred to the name of the party rather than he, because there are two he's here. Mr. Reisman didn't want to do this work, then he could have hired someone, right?
Yes.
But he didn't. That was his choice, right?
Yes.
Without consultation with the other partner.
Yes.
So my problem in this case is that fairness might be on your side. He's put in a lot of time and effort, and he's been successful. right?
Yes.
But you got statutes that are clear on their face. No remuneration. So I don't see how the court can get around that issue when the trial court finds a winding up and not a continuation. And I don't quite understand how you put equity into it.
Your Honor, in this respect, we have moved the court on the issue of 75106, the real matter in controversy, and it's a position of the plaintiff, the appellant rather, Mr. Bouchat, Mr. Reisman, that equity needs to be applied in each of these circumstances. I think that's what the holding in the Madison case is, that equity obtains. And that's a response to Gull, which said in there, if it's to be modified, the legislature can do that if it wants. But then Madison comes along and says you apply equity every time out. And that's not been done in this case to do the accounting and find who owes what to whom. But if you look at those two cases I cited, Gull and Lange, Your Honor, clearly there can be a judgment made or value imputed as to what the amounts were at the relevant times. And in that circumstance, there has been payment to Mr. Bouchard.
Well, Gull says that if you have extra compensation, let the legislature do it. I'll tell you what I think is an issue. I think that there's an issue in these cases that in Lange held, as I understand it, all dissolutions cause a winding up rather than a continuation. But the estate of Schaefer and Bloomer held that a continuation may result from acquiescence. But in this case, we've got apparently the agreement of the partners, or a partner, that it's going to be a winding up process, and that the trial court found that as a matter of fact, so we never get to this other issue of what is the default decision. So that's what is of utmost importance in my mind, and this case doesn't seem to raise the issue.
Respectfully, I think it does, Your Honor, in the interest of justice. I don't think it's the name that is determinative. If it is a wind-up or is it a continuation, that doesn't dictate whether or not there's been fair treatment, respectfully. And when we look at that and apply equity, there has been fair treatment given to Mr. Bouchard, which is our point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Jacobson, representing David Bouchard. Mr. Jacobson.
May it please the court. This case involves application of the Uniform Partnership Act to the dissolution of the Bouchard and Reisman partnership. Bouchard chose to dissolve the partnership and gave notice for winding up the partnership. Reisman confirmed it as a winding up of the partnership by continuing following the notice to pay Bouchard his share of the profits, which is consistent with the notice indicating winding up. Bouchard later brought suit to compel completion of the windup and to compel Reisman to reimburse the partnership for amounts he improperly took as salary and which he took in addition to his share of the profits. Reisman filed a motion for summary judgment, and consistent with Bouchard's notice of dissolution and how Reisman handled the dissolution up to that point, presented to the circuit court that the partnership was in windup, that continuation had not been consented to, and that Bouchard shared in profits or incurred his share of losses until termination. But he argued on the basis of that he was entitled to a salary. Reisman presented to the court that the partnership was in windup, both in his original brief and in his reply brief. He said that it, to the circuit court, that it was an undisputed fact that it was in windup. He said that in his reply brief. The circuit court found the partnership was in windup and that in implying the Uniform Partnership Act, Reisman was not entitled to a salary. Thereafter, Bouchard moved the court to compel Reisman to reimburse the partnership for amounts taken and to complete the windup. Only after 8 years, when he had, Mr. Reisman had treated it as a windup, and after arguing and presenting to the circuit court that it was a windup, did he then, out of convenience, attempt to change his position and contend that, in fact, it may have been a continuation instead of a windup. But he's barred by changing his position by the rules of summary judgment. The trial court appropriately found that it was an undisputed fact that the parties, that the partnership was in windup, and that it was a windup in a windup mode. And he's barred by, if that were to be changed, it would make the summary judgment process undercut it, and it certainly would be contrary to that process. And he is barred, Reisman is barred by judicial estoppel from changing his position. He asked the court to accept particular facts, and then when the court did so and ruled on the basis of those facts, he sought to change his position because he thought a different position was now more convenient.
Counselor, is the reason that you think he cannot have taken a salary because of 178.15 sub 6 and the word surviving partner in that statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
Any other reason besides that?
Well, there, I think it would be inequitable as well, but I certainly think that it's barred by the clear language of the statute and the way the court has consistently interpreted that statute and applied that statute.
What about the same term, surviving partner, in 178.32? How do you interpret it there?
Pardon me?
What about the same term, surviving partner, in 178.32? How do you interpret it there?
In 178.32?
Yeah.
Well, the court has applied, as if I recall correctly, Your Honor, 178.32 involves a continuation situation?
It's the right to wind up, 178.32. It says, unless otherwise agreed, the partners who have wrongfully dissolved the partnership or the legal representative of the last surviving partner, not bankrupt, has the right to wind up the partnership affairs. So, again, the term surviving partner is used in that section. And I'm wondering if you think that should be interpreted as everybody else has died, and so that's why he's the surviving partner in 178.32.
Well, I think that the courts have consistently interpreted one to indicate that the partner that dissolves the partnership is entitled to a windup.
Right. I don't have a dispute with you on that. My concern is the interpretation of surviving partner, and I am wondering if perhaps we should reconsider the interpretation of that term and not limit it to all the other partners are dead, so now you have a surviving partner, or whether the surviving partner may be the person who continues in the partnership.
No, Your Honor, I definitely don't think so. That would be, well, the legislature could have changed. This statute, 178.415, sub 6, has been consistently interpreted by the courts to apply and only in the situation where a partner is deceased. And the court has not chosen to amend that or make a change in that.
Well, maybe they haven't been requested to make a change in it and to compare how that same term is used in 178.32 and 178.15.6.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I know that as Justice...
Well, it also appears in 178.21.3d.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it seems to me quite clear there that they're talking about deceased partners and those who live on. And is that the usual interpretation? What about
it? He said it's the usual interpretation.
Interpretation in the way that 178.15.
But when you say usual interpretation, is that from other states in the Uniform Partnership Act?
Well, I believe it's been applied definitely consistently in other states. The Uniform Partnership Act, of course, has been adopted in numerous states. And that's the way that it has been applied in other states is consistent with the definition of surviving partner as normal, as the way that for surviving is the way that term is normally interpreted.
Mr. Jacobson, clearly Mr. Reisman provided services over a number of years. Why should there not be a claim here under the theory of unjust enrichment? What's wrong with that approach?
Well, Your Honor, unjust enrichment doesn't apply for a couple of reasons. The main reason, of course, is the application of the statute. It's undisputed that it was in a wind-up mode and that they each were entitled to their share of the profits, and 178.15 precludes taking a salary. So what Mr. Bouchard got was just what he was legally entitled to, and so there can't be a claim for unjust enrichment for getting what you're legally entitled to get.
Well, if we look at equitable principles here, and we say one guy is working for a number of years on behalf of the partnership, and the other guy isn't doing anything, wouldn't equity lead us to a theory of unjust enrichment, even though the language of the partnership law, Uniform Partnership Act, would not allow it? That doesn't mean the ball game's over because there's one avenue that's closed, does it?
Well, as the circuit court judge pointed out, it's a backdoor way, an attempt to get around the statute in a backdoor way. But beyond that, Your Honor, those amounts that Mr. Bouchard received were voluntarily paid to him. They were voluntarily paid to him, and he would naturally conclude that he's entitled to get what's voluntarily paid to him. And it would certainly be detrimental to him, to Mr. Bouchard, if he had to repay amounts that were voluntarily paid to him and for which he received a K-1. This is not a situation where he demanded that he get paid those amounts, and they were voluntarily paid, and he had to write to those amounts. So I don't think he has been unjustly enriched. With respect to the salary amount taking a salary, Mr. Reisman was an owner. He wasn't an employee. Furthermore, he's a businessman. And he had access to lawyers. The right to the application of the Uniform Partnership Act with respect to the no remuneration rule applies in the absence of an agreement. There's nothing in the record to suggest that there was such an agreement, that he would receive a salary. There's nothing in the record to suggest that he even asked for such an agreement. He continued to do that work voluntarily. Nobody forced him to. Mr. Bouchard didn't force him to. He could have stopped if he wanted to. He could have sought to hire people to do that work instead
of him. But, Counselor, if he stopped, then the partnership couldn't be maintained as a going concern. So if your client gives notice of dissolution and maybe he works for a while and, you know, decides it's just he's doing a lot of work and your client is staying home, if he stops, they both get nothing. Well, I mean, so it's to me it seems I can understand Justice's Crooks about the questions about equity, because if someone doesn't work to keep the partnership going, there is nothing to sell as a going concern, right? You just sell the hard assets and then you're done, pay the liabilities.
Well, they could, yes. When Mr. Bouchard asked for dissolution of the partnership, he's asking that the partnership be wound up.
Right, but he asked for that at the time he thought there was going to be an offer at $3.9 million. And I think that both partners agreed to sell it for that price, but then the price didn't work out to be a firm price. And as I understand from the record, they both agreed not to go forward with the offer that they thought was there at wind-up, correct?
Well, the record, I think, is that they had differing thoughts about the reason that that particular offer, the Voyager Net offer, fell through.
Right, but they both decided that it wasn't a viable offer at some point in time, correct? Your client didn't try to force a sale to Voyager.
My client wanted to press forward and make further concessions. That's
Is it clear in the record that if Mr. Reisman had not done these services, that this would have ended this partnership business, that there was no way of hiring anyone else to do what Mr. Reisman was doing? Is that in the record?
It is not clear in the record that that would be the case. There's nothing in the record to indicate that he couldn't have hired somebody to perform work that he performed.
What's in the record is that he did perform these services. They were of value to the entity.
Yes, and I would also add this, that what Mr. Reisman continuing to do the work was very beneficial to him, because he was receiving profits, his share of the profits. He was in control and was making decisions for the business. He was operating the business. And he was doing it using Mr. Bouchard's capital.
So was there an unequal contribution of capital in this case to the partnership to begin with?
There was an equal contribution of capital to begin with. Each contributed an equal amount, and then in addition there was a loan that was taken out. But Mr. Bouchard was an entrepreneur.
He was a what?
He was an entrepreneur. He set up this business. He was instrumental in getting this going, this successful business. He contributed a lot to the formation of the business. The first customers came from this bulletin board that he kept called the Swamp before he had the idea to start this business. So this was a going concern that Mr. Bouchard set up before he sent the notice of dissolution. Mr. Reisman benefited himself. He continued to operate the business, but he did so using Mr. Bouchard's capital. He could do so without having to buy out Mr. Bouchard.
Mr. Jacobson, are you done? Go ahead and complete your statement.
Yeah, he could do that without having to buy out Mr. Bouchard. And he got substantial personal benefits from doing so. He at no time demanded that he be paid. He at no time asked that they enter into some agreement that he be paid for his work. So it isn't as though Mr. Reisman was treated unfairly or that he, Mr. Bouchard, received disproportionate benefits. He did not.
Before this wind-up issue, did Mr. Reisman work in the entity and Mr. Bouchard was not active per se on a day-to-day working in the entity? What I'm trying to figure out in the fairness concept that Justice Crooks raised, that there are different contributions to an entity. One would be the day-to-day operations, et cetera. Another is more capital. Another is what you define as perhaps, I would say, intangible contributions. And so is this all in the record?
It's in the record in terms of the about what the role that they each played at the beginning in the setting up of this
and
enterprise.
And did Mr. Reisman work in the entity?
They both worked in the entity.
But
they
differently.
They both worked full-time in the entity at the beginning and before the notice of dissolution. And Mr. Reisman continued to work in the entity, but that was no different than what he had done before.
Mr. Jacobson,
previously they were both sharing profits. Neither was getting a salary.
I'd like to ask you about a topic that I previously asked Mr. Ryberg about, picked up upon by the Chief Justice, in regard to your client's notice and awareness of the payments, which had been delineated in the briefing as guaranteed draws or salary. What does the record indicate as to your client's awareness and notice of those payments?
He received notice 2 years after Mr. Reisman began taking it. Now, it wouldn't appear it was lumped together. He did receive summary financial statements, but it was lumped together with other compensation, so he couldn't tell that Mr. Reisman was taking a salary. And I don't think that there would be that would be broken down on a tax return either. I think that it would still be lumped together as an expense for salaries and wages. He learned about it only 2 years after Mr. Reisman began taking the salary, and then shortly after that, informed Mr. Reisman that he objected to it.
You started earlier enumerating different options in regard to what Mr. Reisman could have done under the circumstances, but what I haven't heard yet is any reason why Mr. Reisman could not have approached your client in regard to working out some sort of agreement. Obviously, this was an ongoing concern. Mr. Reisman, one could reasonably infer he did a good job in managing and running the operations, as evidenced by $2.4 million distributed to each partner. I asked Mr. Ryberg if there was anything in the record to indicate why no such agreement was at least broached.
There's nothing in the record to indicate that such an agreement was requested, and there's nothing about why that would be done. What he went for several years without taking a salary during the time that there were substantial profits, and then when the business, the amount of the profits began to decline, then he, unbeknownst to Mr. Bouchard, began taking a salary, evidently to compensate himself for the fact that the profits were declining. And so that's what happened.
How did your client learn about the payments?
He heard about the payments through a letter that Mr. Reisman did write to him, commenting that the profit that the businesses, and this was in 2006 and is in the record, that the profits were declining, and that he did indicate in that letter that he was taking a salary. That was 2 years after he started.
So my concern is this. What role, if any, does equity play in our analysis?
Let me refine the question with a preface. I think that with regard to the statute, cases, Gull particularly, suggest that, and I shouldn't say suggest, state that 178.15.6, the phrase survivor, the phrase surviving partner, means one is dead.
Yes.
I think that the Uniform Act under which this was enacted meant that. And just like Gull says, okay, that old Uniform Act was criticized because it might not have been fair. In fact, the Uniform Act was changed in 1993, I guess it was, to take into consideration some of the unfairness. But as Gull says, but hey, the Wisconsin legislature never did it. So we've got the old Uniform Act, and it's consistently been interpreted to mean someone had to die for there to be a surviving partner. So I start with that premise. I don't know what role equity plays and who is to play it, what court is to play it. On one side of this case, there are equitable arguments. Hey, you know, one fellow did a lot more work than the other. But on the other hand, I say to myself, look, if this is all going to be reduced to, what seems fair today? What is it, a Thursday? Yeah. What seems fair today on Thursday, the 14th of April? It disregards all of the laws, you know, the Uniform Partnership Act and how the law is put together and when people rely on the language. And so I don't know what role equity should play. We've got all of these laws. We've got a lot of stuff in the statute books. A lot of work went into adopting these and a lot of work went into people relying on what these words mean. But let's just do equity and forget the words. Now, I'm not saying that that's wrong because I think that when you're dealing with a wind-up, you want a fair accounting. That suggests a certain kind of equity. But then who does it? As the Court of Appeals asks, is the trial court required to consider equitable principles when ordering parties to complete a wind-up? Does this court, if the court, circuit court didn't do it, is this court supposed to say, doesn't seem fair to me? So I get back to, what role does equity play and who is to play it?
Yeah. Well, I'd say that if equity is the same as public policy, then the statute is this public policy of the state. And that's so the statute embodies the legislature's determination of what is equitable and appropriate. Now, the posture of this case is that it arose on a summary judgment motion, and there was a determination appropriately made by the trial court that it was in wind-up. There are statutory parameters or statutory requirements that flow from that, including that each partner gets his share of the profits, and that's the way it was consistently handled and treated in this case by both parties. I'd point out that it was never treated as continuation. It was always treated as wind-up.
Counselor, was
and,
there...
And so,
I'm sorry, go I, ahead. Go ahead. No, you go ahead and finish. I'm sorry. I thought you were finished.
So in the posture of this case, we have clear rules which are being applied in this case to determine the issues. Equity may play a role, but not with respect to the application of the statute in this case, the Uniform Partnership Act. I think it can be clearly applied. We don't need to go beyond that, and the statute does reflect what is equitable. And I'd also say, as I tried to point out before, that there's nothing inequitable about what's taken place in this case. I think that Mr. Reisman consistently treated it as a wind-up, and he never asked for a salary. He had a perfect right to contract if he needed to or asked to enter into a contract. He didn't do that, and he benefited more, at least as much and more than Mr. Bouchard by continuing this. The Schaefer case indicates that a wind-up can be slow. So there's no time parameter in the statute on wind-up.
Counselor, was there a certificate of limited partnership filed for this partnership?
Yes, it was limited.
Was
limited
it ever liability. Canceled?
Pardon me?
Was that certificate of limited partnership ever canceled?
Not to my knowledge.
Why is it that you all are arguing then under Chapter 178 rather than under Chapter 179?
I believe that 178 applies.
You think that 178 applies rather than Chapter 179?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because you're dealing with the two general partners?
Pardon me?
Because you're dealing with the two general partners?
Yes.
So between them, the general partnership law applies. That's your position?
Yes.
As to relationships with the limited partners, you'd go to 179. Oh, the Limited Partnership Act. Is that right? I mean, that's the question that's asked of you.
Well,
I think when you can terminate a general partnership after giving notice of dissolution and winding it up, and when you get everything wound up, then the partnership terminates. But that isn't the mechanism for a limited partnership under the statute. So, you know, I thought probably it had been canceled. Frankly, that's why I asked you the question. But if the certificate hasn't been canceled, then legally this entity is a limited partnership, not a general partnership, correct?
Well, I haven't looked into whether it's been canceled.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a
fair question. Are there any limited partners left? Are there any limited partners left?
Oh, no. They're general partners. There's no limited partners that exist. They never have existed.
Okay.
Could I ask, what does the record show about any discussion or negotiations for one partner to buy out the other?
Pardon me?
Did Mr. Reisman try to buy out the other, Mr. Bouchard?
No.
There's never any discussion.
He never attempted to buy out Mr. Bouchard. And a dissolution, a wind-up can take place through liquidation by sale of the business, one partner buying out another partner, assets being distributed in kind, or assets being sold. So there's a number of ways that a termination can take place. Mr. Reisman continued to clearly was satisfied that with the situation, he never attempted to buy out Mr. Bouchard. There's nothing on the record to indicate that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ryberg.
Counsel mentions that a wind-up can be slow. Can it be permanent? Because that's essentially what you've sentenced Mr. Reisman to do all of the work, try to sell it, and keep on going inexorably. That can't be appropriate in the law, and that's why the two cases, Gull and the Lane case, talking about attributing value to the business and then making an accounting and seeing if people were treated fairly. It's our position, as I've stated to the court before, that effectively the wind-up occurred with value being met,
And that was the only way it could be done in these circumstances. He got paid more than value with regard to that. Counsel said that there was interest in going with the Voyager.net offer, but the parties implying that Mr. Reisman was not in favor of that. That's not what the evidence in the case is. R-26 is the affidavit of Mr. Bush, who was involved on behalf of the partnership to negotiate with Voyager.net, and he said that he went back and forth with Voyager to try to get the matter done, and ultimately Mr. Jacobberger, the attorney, and Mr. Bouchard did not express any interest in following up further to conclude the sale with Voyager. So it's left in the posture that he can work less than 6 days, cause Mr. Reisman to do all of the work, and if he drops the ball and doesn't do the work, can make a claim for breach of fiduciary duty as to Mr. Reisman. That is not appropriate in this case.
If Mr. Reisman did not do the work, would the partnership have had to hire someone else to do the work to keep it as a going concern?
Oh, at least hire one or three or four people. Likely would have failed. I think the evidence in this record is that he was the fellow technologically and scientifically advanced. He was the individual who drove this, who made the deals with all of the telephone companies, who had all of the technology and brought the skill to bear. And it's not like capital is driving this business. It's the intelligence and the mind of Mr. Reisman that made the business. So for him to be in the position of, it's like Sisyphus. He is trying to work daily to make it go, trying to sell the business. He can't sell the business. So what you're saying is that too bad, so sad forever? Well, that can't be right. And that's where the language that I cited at 622 in Gull and 604 in Lane come in to say that you attribute value and you make value. And when you make value in this case, you find that he got paid the appropriate amount of money.
Why didn't he try to buy the business?
Why didn't he try? That's not in the record, Your Honor. I suspect it was that they thought they could sell the business, and the business was doing very well. So it wasn't as though they were interested in a fire sale, and certainly Mr. Bouchard was not going to complain with these monthly payments coming into him. But he was not in position. I don't want to overstate what that record is on that, Your Honor. There's not specific reference to that, except that they tried multiple times to make the sale, and it was unable to be done. Judicial estoppel and equitable estoppel are raised in the case. Judicial estoppel, we don't think, fits the three cases cited, the Harrison, Petty, and the Salveson case. In none of those are cited by the respondents in the case. None of those they apply judicial estoppel. And if anybody can figure if there's inconsistency in this case, if there's success that I attained or that the facts are the same, be my guest to make that judgment. I look at Schaefer. I look at the Lange case. I look at Gull, and you cannot make sense of what the status of the record is, except it's paramount. When you look at the Lange case, when you look at the Gull case, when you look at the Madison case, that you apply equity, and I think Madison is the latest word that addresses the concept or the statement made in Gull. If this is to be looked at, the legislature ought to do that. Well, the court elected to take that and said that equity ought to govern these kinds of matters, and it has the right. So responding to Your Honor's question, equity should obtain, and the trial court ought to do it. And this is a perfect circumstance for that to be done.
Counselor, do you know whether the certificate of limited partnership was ever canceled?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
With respect to the issue...
Can I just interrupt you for a minute? 178.02 says, rules of construction. In any case not provided for in this chapter, the rules of law and equity, including the law merchant, shall govern. So the question is, if it's covered by a section of the chapter, we don't have general rules of law and equity aside from this covering.
So you're saying that one...
I'm asking you, how do you fit in subsection 6 in your argument? And subsection 1 on the rules of construction say, the rule that statutes in derogation of the common law are to be strictly construed shall have no application to this chapter. It says the law of estoppel shall apply to this chapter.
Well, Your Honor,
in the circumstance, if I look at 178.33 on how you do the windup, it says may. It doesn't say shall. You shall do it in that circumstance. So I would maintain under sub 6 of 178.02, this is likely a case that the particular is not a fit for this chapter. In other words, that you can't make the sale, you can't terminate the business, so effectively you can rely upon equity, and I think that's what the holding in Madison said. On the issue of equitable estoppel, if I may address that, Your Honor.
Just in one or two sentences, counsel, please.
Pardon me?
Just in one or two sentences, counsel, please.
Thank you. I didn't realize the red light was on. The equitable estoppel, I don't think he has any application in this case because if he got more than what was reasonable and fair value, an accounting would reconcile that and explain where we were, and we ought to get back to that. Finally, Your Honors, thank you for this opportunity. It's a case that is likely to be repeated if you can't do the sale, but you shouldn't have to do all the work either. And this is a wonderful gig for Mr. Bouchard, but it's not fair to Mr. Reisman. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank you, Attorney Ryberg, and you, Attorney Jacobson, for excellent arguments and briefs today on an issue in partnership law that has not directly come before us, but in other cases has been touched upon. That concludes our hearing in 09-AP-438. David Bouchard versus Stephen A. Reisman. The court will take a few minutes in recess because we have additional students coming in and these students may want to leave. We are in recess.